Hey, we all know how tough it can be to find the time to sit down and make progress on a book you've been trying to read. Tell me about it. I've got two kids. But what if I told you it's possible to absorb 10 nonfiction books in just an afternoon? Well, that's exactly what today's sponsor, Blinkist.com/ROF, allows you to do. Blinkist is the only app that takes popular nonfiction books, distills them down into summaries that you can read or listen to in about 15 minutes. You'll still get the most important takeaways and the crucial information from each book, but it'll be so in a concise, efficient package that you can consume in one sitting or at the gym or on your way to work or in between podcasts. Now look, I know I want to make time for reading as many books as I can, but there's only so many hours in the week. So why not go ahead and get the most valuable insights from nonfiction books that you otherwise wouldn't have had time for? They have everything from politics, history, philosophy, to economics, business, psychology, and personal development. You can try Blinkist totally free and get access to their library of thousands of condensed nonfiction books by going to Blinkist.com/ROF. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST.com/ROF. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. My name is Sam Cedar. On today's show, Lisa Hymas, she is the Director of Climate and Energy Program at Media Matters of America, will tell us about the dearth of climate change coverage on the mainstream media. Investigative journalist David Dane will be here to tell us about the new economic concentration that has permeated our economy. And Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to help me run down all the news that made headlines this week. Have you signed up for the Ring of Fire Radio podcast yet? Well, you can help support this show by going to ROFpodcast.com. You can sign up for the free 1-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member and help keep us on the air. It's the best way to support this show. That's ROFpodcast.com. Or simply find us on iTunes, the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. Here to run down the biggest stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her from her blog, Hullabaloo Digby. So, Heather, another just crazy week during the Trump administration. That's the way it goes. And I want to start with something that we didn't talk about last week because the story had just broke. And I think it was on Thursday. It's good when stories of this nature break to take a beat, get a sense. Very often what we see with stories about the Mueller investigation is that one story breaks with one media outlet and the other media outlets, the major media outlets who have part of the story run with their versions of the story because the cat's out of the bag, as it were. Or they go and check with their sources and they look for validation. And of course, I'm talking about this BuzzFeed story that came out a week ago last Thursday. And it suggested that two law enforcement officials with knowledge of what was in, if not the testimony of Michael Cohen, the president's personal lawyer, certainly within documents or perhaps tapes, suggested that Donald Trump had told Michael Cohen to lie essentially to Congress. And there were non-denials, frankly, by the administration when the story came out. Within, I think it was 24 hours, Robert Mueller's investigation issued a very rare press release saying that there were inaccuracies in that story. And it was not specific as to what the inaccuracies were. Donald Trump and the administration and the Trumpistas and the media all essentially said, wait a second, this is a learning, a teachable moment for us. And suddenly Mueller had credibility with Donald Trump and et cetera, et cetera. And I know that you read Marcy Wheeler in the same way that I do. And Marcy Wheeler suggested that what was going on is that those two law enforcement officers were probably somewhat involved with the Southern District of New York's investigation of Michael Cohen. They were looking for criminal time for him. They got it, I think, in the form of 3 years. They did not need his cooperation in their investigations. They do not need to protect him as a credible witness, whereas Mueller does. And Marcy Wheeler suggested that was part of the dynamic that was going on there. I'm curious as to what your take is now as we look back on that over the past week.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, like everybody else, when I first read it, it did sound as though BuzzFeed had something new, which was some kind of, the main thrust of that article that they published was that there was not just that Trump had directed Cohen to lie, but that there was documentary evidence of that, and that there were, you know, tapes, files, text, something in the article, which was something that we had not seen before, and that seemed very damning, to say the least. Now, before I get into that, I just want to make one point really clear that everybody says that this is about suborning perjury. It really isn't. Apparently, this is not a suborning. This, even in that case, it wouldn't be a suborning perjury case necessarily. There are other statutes that cover this that have to do with. I'm sorry I brought this up because I can't think of the actual legal phrase for it. But I read a long article about it on Lawfare for people who are, or lawyers who obviously know this. There are other statutes that would cover this besides suborning perjury. And I'm just throwing that out there because this is, it's important to kind of ensure that you're not getting ahead of yourself on any of this stuff. And everybody was throwing that around, and apparently it's not quite a precise sort of definition of what was being alleged in that BuzzFeed article. In any case, setting that aside, when we found out that when the Mueller team came out and said this, it was everybody went, oh my God. And as you point out, this was again, sort of an overcorrection in which everybody, oh my God, we got it wrong. And, this is terrible. And Trump is running around taking victory laps, thanking the 12 angry Democrats and the dirty cops of Mueller's investigation for being so honest and true. I mean, it's a bizarre situation.
Right.
But I think that Marcy, I agree with you. I think that Marcy's analysis is probably it's the thing that makes the most sense to me, is that you have two different teams here. You have the SDNY and you have the special counsel's office, who are don't necessarily have the same goals, although they are, working together. The law enforcement officers, also Marcy pointed out, probably only saw certain aspects of this case. In other words, they don't know the full extent of what Cohen has told Mueller. What
Right.
they know is what came through to them in that particular small, tiny little sliver of the Cohen-Russia case, because that plea agreement went through the Southern District of New York. And so they got access to certain information that came through that, but that's very limited. And as she points out, the Mueller investigation has bigger fish to fry. And so they are trying to maintain Cohen as some kind of a credible witness, and what that BuzzFeed story implied was that Cohen had lied in his plea agreement and that he had lied in his allocution to the court, because in the court he never said that Trump directed him. He said that he was following what the public relations
strategy was,
which is not the same thing.
Right.
I mean, what that says is it's like Trump is the mob boss. He says, hey, you know what to do, right? And he goes, yeah, boss, no problem. I mean, that's what we're talking. And that's very different than what they were saying as a direct, order to lie to the Congress.
Right. So, I mean, that's fascinating, you know, as it was. And there hasn't been really any resolution in one way or another. BuzzFeed is sticking with their story. And obviously, you know, the Mueller investigation is not getting involved in some type of back and forth on this. What is fascinating is, though, is that Michael Cohen was scheduled to testify to Congress. I think it was on February 7th. And on Wednesday of this week, this past week, he announced that he was postponing that testimony because of threats from Donald Trump. Now, let's take a break. Let's talk about that when we come back, because there's so many different spinoffs to this week in that, you know, coming out of that that exchange between Mueller and BuzzFeed that are intriguing. And it is also perhaps the final week of the tenure, I should say, of Rudy Giuliani, as having gone from America's mayor to America's chief liar to now just sad afterthought. But we will talk about that when we return. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with Digby. Can you even see what you're fighting for? Bloodlust and a holy war. Listen up, hear the patriots shout. Time's up. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, in the first segment, we were hearkening back and sort of reassessing that BuzzFeed article from, you know, what feels like, you know, months ago. It was only less than a week and a half ago. The BuzzFeed article dropped, and of course, Mueller subsequently, through his spokesperson, said there are inaccuracies. We talked about the possibility that what we're seeing is really not necessarily two competing police agencies, but we're seeing two agendas or incentive structures that are in conflict with each other. One from the Mueller investigation, which is preserve the integrity of Michael Cohen as a witness by perhaps, frankly, not showing ever, you know, not planning to ever show evidence that Donald Trump attempted to or did order him to lie to Congress. Whereas the Southern District of New York, those folks don't feel that that's necessary. Maybe they're under the impression that Michael Cohen is getting away with something and they want to try and sink this guy's boat or something. There's going to be a whole set of like B stories, if you will, mm-hmm. or maybe even C narratives that we're never going to know about. I'm quite convinced that are going to be about differing problems that might be interagency problems, you know, particularly when we're talking about New York. I think there's a lot of weirdness there, a lot of different cross currents with Felix Sater, who is a longtime FBI and CIA informant / asset who worked for Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani, who had relationships with members of the New York FBI office, that New York FBI office. There was some point during the run-up to the 2016 election that people were talking about a mutiny that was brewing there, some type of, you know, one person at the, I remember at the time people were suggesting, well, Comey had to come out with that letter about Anthony Weiner's computer because of New York FBI agents were upset. I mean, there's some storyline there that I don't know that we're ever going to hear. And I wonder if this isn't part of it. But I also wonder what the implications are of Michael Cohen punting his testimony to Congress. I frankly don't buy the reason they gave for it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, there's a lot of evidence. shouldn't say evidence. There's a lot of you know, sort of sinister rumors about Cohen's family, specifically his wife's family. Rudy Giuliani went on Jake Tapper over the weekend and said that, again, you know, sort of doubled down on this threat to go after Cohen's family, saying that he's Ukrainian, and to which Tapper said, well, that's not a crime. But Giuliani says, well, it's not a crime, but this has to do with organized crime. And, you know, if he says anything, you know, if he gets put in the spotlight, you know, he's not going to be very welcome at Brighton Beach anymore, sort of implying that they're going to whack him or something. You know, I mean, I've been doing this my whole life, you know, Giuliani says. So basically what he's implying is that Cohen's father-in-law is a member of the Russian mafia or the Ukrainian mafia. I didn't know there were those kind of fine distinctions, but apparently there are. I mean, that's essentially what he was saying. So they're throwing that out there. And there is some reason that Cohen refused to give all the evidence, and I don't know what it is. Perhaps it's that, perhaps it's something else. But the fact that that Trump and his attorney are out there in public saying this, I wouldn't be surprised to see, you know, and Cohen now saying, well, I'm afraid for my life and my wife doesn't want to come out in public, et cetera, et cetera. It may all be BS as far as his reasoning for not wanting to do it. And I would not be surprised to find out that the Mueller team is quite happy that he's not going to be, you know, that he's balking at this, because they have their own, you know, they want to keep as much of this buttoned up as they can. However, I also think that the fact that Trump and his attorney are out there doing this in public implicates them once again in witness tampering.
This is witness tampering. We've seen that. It's witness tampering. I mean, and it's explicit.
It's not the first time that's come up in this case. Right. Remember, Manafort was hit for it as well. So, yep. I mean, these people doing this stuff, going out there and in Trump's case and Giuliani's, they're going on television and doing it. They're doing it on Twitter. I mean, they're not even trying to hide it. So, you know, once that just sort of adds, you know, once again, I wouldn't even be surprised to find out that Cohen was doing this at the behest of the Mueller. I shouldn't say at the behest. Mueller would never ask him to do it. But if, you know, if Mueller said, well, you know, if you're going to back out of this, you know, this, you know, if you really feel that you're afraid for your family, perhaps you want to tell the Congress that. That's probably how it would be put. Because it does sort of expose him. I mean, you've got somebody, an actual person who has standing to say, look what they're doing to me.
Well,
and, you know, and again, it may even be true that Cohen's family is involved in some kind of nefarious deals. We don't know what that's all about. So, I mean, this whole thing is really a mess, and I cannot get past the fact, and I don't think most decent people can, that the President of the United States and his lawyer are out there sounding like Joe Pesci in Goodfellas half the time. I mean, this is unbelievable.
It's unbelievable, and I would also say that it is, if he is, I mean, it, two things can be true. One could be that he's worried about his family's exposure, although that would be sort of late to the game, right? Like, I would imagine Cohen's been aware of that exposure for some time when he agreed to testify to Congress. But it also could be that he knows, that Mueller knows, this question is going to be asked of Cohen. Cohen doesn't want to have to answer that question because he needs to be preserved.
Yep.
It would also suggest that maybe can't be preserved for an indefinite period of time, that maybe the Mueller investigation, we're going to see some things drop soon. Tough to say, but I can say that we need to take a break. Digby, if you'll join me in the next hour, that would be great. In the meantime, I'm Sam Seder. We'll be right back with more Ring of Fire Radio. Just ahead, David Dayen on the new economic concentration that has permeated our economy in America over the past 40 years. You are listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. Maybe you got this through iTunes. Maybe you got it through ROFpodcast.com. Either way, thank you for listening. But you should hear what you're missing. There's two more hours of the program, two more radio hours, I should say. And frankly, it's our members who support this show and keep us on the radio and able to produce a weekly podcast. Why not join them? If you enjoy listening to the program, support it. Just a couple of bucks a week, you get more content, you get access to our archives, you keep this show going. Head over to ROFpodcast.com. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the program. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. David Dayan, a writer who covered a lot of the problems following the financial crisis and leading up to the financial crisis in 2008, took a look at two different books, The Myth of Capitalism, Monopolies and the Death of Competition by Jonathan Tepper, and The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust and the New Gilded Age by Tim Wu, to examine our new economic concentration. Here to explain, David Dayan. So, David, you're writing in the American Prospect about two different books that address the new economic concentration we have in this country from slightly different angles. One of the books is written by Jonathan Tepper. He's a macroeconomic analyst for hedge funds and high net worth individuals. And the other, Tim Wu, who is an academic, but one of the people, like one of the initial, architects of the concept of net neutrality, and juxtaposed that notion of net neutrality, or I guess broadened it out to a larger critique of the concentration in our capitalism today. Let's start with Tepper's book. What is it, and how did he come to write it? Because it's a fascinating story.
It is an interesting story. As you said, Tepper is this analyst for hedge funds. He runs in these rarefied circles, and he lives in London. And what he said to me is that the Piketty book came out, you know, Capitalism and the Capital in the 21st Century. And, you know, this is a guy that is a pretty high-powered capitalist. He does economic reports for very high net worth individuals. And he looked at the Piketty book, and there was kind of a knee-jerk kind of resistance to it. But he said, you know, he had trouble defending capitalism. When he would go down to the pub and talk to his friends, he couldn't see his way through to defend a system that he felt had, you know, really gone off the rails, and he couldn't argue with sort of the results of capitalism in terms of how economic inequality has just skyrocketed. And he searched sort of for a meaning to it. And in particular, he was doing his reports, and all of his economic indicators were showing that wages were going to go way up. Like everything that he normally collected for years and years and years over decades showed that wages were about to spike, and they didn't. And he couldn't figure out why. Why aren't these wages going up when everything that he had previously known and been trained to see as a pattern wasn't working? So he, you know, tried to figure it out. And what he ultimately came upon is the fact that large corporations have taken over so many sectors of our economy that there are fewer and fewer hands in which all of the gains are going. And this, you know, monopolism or economic concentration has caused these distortions within economics that has broken the channel that he was looking at between productivity and wages. And so he gets so fed up that he ends up writing this book to explain how capitalism is failing.
And we should say that dynamic where the buyers of labor don't have any competition, and so prices for labor stay low, is known as monopsony.
Right.
And this dynamic is something that I think it's hard for folks to wrap their heads around a little bit, because it's sort of the mirror image of a monopoly when you're the only person selling something. But in this instance, it is just another. It is about concentration within the marketplace fundamentally both alters the economics and the politics around it. And so when he goes into this book, Myth of Capitalism, is this the biggest culprit? I mean, what does he see as the outcomes that he couldn't defend, and what was driving those?
Well, right. I mean, just to briefly just sort of elaborate on monopsony, it's, you know, say that you are a fisherman and that's your trade and you catch six fish every day. And instead of 20 people bargaining with you to buy the fish, suddenly there are two. And this is just supply and demand, right? I mean, there's less demand for the services because these two monopolists, who are the ones who get the fish into people's plates, are there are just fewer of them. There's less demand for the services of labor. So
I mean, there's less demand insofar as obviously there's this equal amount of demand for the fish, right? Between those two fish buyers, they're going to deliver the same amount of fish. The problem is there's less competition and less demand on just that, on that, I guess, that wholesale side.
Well, yeah, that's correct. And so that creates this effect. But that's not, of course, the only effect that monopolies create within an economy. And Tepper does a pretty good job of listing all of them. It's not just higher prices that you pay because there is one company that's dominating a particular field. It's the effect on privacy when you're talking about these large tech firms that store all this information on you and follow you around the internet. It's the effect on service quality when there are only a couple airlines, for example, and they, you know, don't have to compete with one another necessarily to get your business because the routes are kind of locked in. And so they squeeze you with more and more restrictions on your travel and worse seating and things like that. So he outlines really a whole host of ancillary effects of this economic concentration. And he, you know, I think does a pretty good job of showing how it's not just any one thing, but it's very cumulative.
And does he have any, I mean, what is this guy who was such an adamant defender of and practitioner of market capitalism? What is his, when he talks about solutions, what are those solutions?
Yeah, I mean, he's really talking about breaking up these large concentrations of power, whether you're talking about Amazon or you're talking about Facebook or you're talking about, you know, I could go down the line. I mean, the Open Markets Institute just put out a study showing numerous sectors that are massively concentrated. So he has a very linear kind of way to go about thinking about it. And also he talks about things, you know, on the labor side, like getting rid of non-compete agreements, which are clauses in labor contracts that say that you as a worker cannot go to a competing business. And this is done in, of all places, in fast food. So you can't bring your superior skills as a fast food clerk from Jimmy John's over to Wendy's. This is just a way to keep prices down for labor. So he has a variety of different ideas, but they all go back to sort of this singular theme that competition, you know, capitalism only works with competition. I believe that's a quote in the book. And without it, we're kind of doomed. So it's time for the antitrust authorities to use, by the way, the authorities they already have through the Sherman Act, through the Clayton Act, through the Federal Trade Commission Act, through the Seller-Kefauver Act, which is an act around chain stores, and Robinson-Patman as well is a chain store act, to really break up these concentrations of power and do it in service to our economy and also, you know, to our democracy.
All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about Tim Wu's book, the Columbia law professor who coined the term net neutrality. He's written a book called The Curse of Bigness. And we'll talk more about what it's going to take to find someone who's going to use the authority that already exists and to what end. What can we anticipate would our economy look like and our society, frankly, look like if we did not allow for such massive concentration of wealth and power and market share. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to investigative journalist David Dayan about the new economic concentration and its implications for everyday Americans. So, David, in the last segment, you told us about one of two books that you were reviewing regarding the new economic concentration. And this has been a big theme for the past 3 or 4 years. A growing awareness of the implications of our lack of antitrust enforcement and, frankly, perspective in this country, one that seemingly has been sidelined since the late 70s, I guess, when Robert Bork was ascendant and he had a new perspective on how we should interpret antitrust law, and it is stuck. And when we get to towards the end here, I want to ask you why you think that is stuck. But that may be baked into the cake to a certain extent in terms of the problems. But let's talk about Tim Wu's book, The Curse of Bigness. How is his argument different from Tepper, who you write about, Jonathan Tepper, sure, in his book, Myth of Capitalism? How is Tim Wu's take on this any different?
Well, Tepper's really describing things as they are today, and I would say that Tim Wu's book, The Curse of Bigness, is more of a historical study. So he goes all the way back to the fact that we've been here before, that in the first Gilded Age, at the end of the 19th century, he does a stat that in the last 10 years of that century, something like 2,300 manufacturing firms merged in a 10-year period, and concentrations of power in the railroads, in steel, in all sorts of industries that were dominant at the time was very prevalent. And what happened is that a grassroots movement led by what's known as the Progressive Era, led by thinkers like Louis Brandeis, and interestingly, led by Teddy Roosevelt, although later Roosevelt sort of switches sides in some ways, they returned sort of this thinking that breaking up these concentrations of power is not only good for the economy, but good for personal liberty, for the idea that you as a worker, as a citizen, should have the ability to pursue whatever talents or skills that you see fit, and you shouldn't have a barrier in the form of a monopoly in the way dictating what you can and can't do. And so that was certainly Brandeis's theory. Brandeis has the famous statements, we either can live in a democracy or we can live in a situation with concentration of power in fewer hands, but we can't have both. So, you know, Wu traces that history, and then he gets to where you started off the segment, which is that we had a sort of somewhat golden age after FDR, where the antitrust enforcers were very strong, more laws were put into place to rein in these monopolies. And then in the 1970s, there's this backlash in the form of Robert Bork, who comes up with this theorem that monopolies are okay as long as they enhance consumer welfare, and a very strained reading, narrow reading of consumer welfare at that. It does take, and it's a form of, you know, it's ushered in with the Reagan Revolution. The Justice Department changes its guidelines in 1982 to narrow what they can actually challenge in terms of monopoly and antitrust. The courts start moving in a very rightward direction on this particular issue. There's sort of a full court press among monopolists themselves and their allies in academia, in the media, in sort of the large businesses. We're sort of, we've moved into the situation where we're in today, where we see over the last 40 years, this extreme concentration continuing in sector after sector.
And the argument is, ultimately, I guess it's twofold. One is that capitalism is a dynamic, and governments set up markets. They exist only because of governments. And the market automatically weighs in. Regardless, there's no such thing as having government not pick winners and losers. And when it recedes and allows for this concentration, it's basically picking winners and keeping everybody else out. And that there needs to be some type of affirmative action by government to make sure that this dynamic is not too coercive, is not too imbalanced. Otherwise, you get problems not just in terms of crappy service with your internet or cable service or limited service, let's say, not just a stagnancy in wages we see in terms of this competition for labor diminished and therefore wages stay low, but also you see a perpetuation of this and other problems, societal ills brought about by the major concentration of power, whether it's Google and Facebook implicating other regulation and how things are done, or stifling entrepreneurship by buying up all these companies, right? Because they don't want different competitors out there. And so new things are not developed. Or frankly, we see it in the context of one of the problems with Facebook or, Google or Twitter is that it is so massive that when they catch a cold, it tramples on the rights of people, whether it's privacy or expression in some respects. I mean, on and on like this. So tell us just the difference. I found this interesting. The difference between regulated monopolies under state control that Roosevelt wanted and Brandeis's idea of just make sure there's no monopolies, that the playing field is more even.
Yeah, that was really the test. And you could look at the 1912 election as this kind of fulcrum point. Roosevelt was president until 1908. He gave over the reins to William Howard Taft, decided midway through that he didn't like what Taft was doing, and ran again as a third-party candidate in 1912 against Taft and Woodrow Wilson. And Brandeis was Wilson's top economic advisor. And so this was really the divide. And Roosevelt really saw that we can tolerate monopolies as long as government is in charge of them. That was essentially Roosevelt's idea, that states would control big business, manage them for the in a benevolent way for the good of the people. Brandeis his idea was no, we don't want states to create monopolies. We want competition to foster within these various markets, and the state should ensure that competition. That should be its role. Its role should not be to regulate these giant concentrated businesses, because ultimately that might fail. I mean, you can see how economic power would be converted into political power, and these allegedly regulated monopolies would gradually become unregulated. I mean, I think we've seen throughout history that happens. So that was the test, and America voted for Woodrow Wilson. The Brandeisian way of looking at this problem, and it was a pretty major point within the 1912 election, won out and stayed that way for close to 60 years. Until, without changing a word of any law, Robert Bork ushered in this revolution.
Well, I guess we're going to have a notion, particularly over the next 2 years, whether we're going to get a little bit closer to that pre-Borkian version of our antitrust perspective in this country. David Dayan, always fascinating. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much.
David Dayan is a contributing writer to Salon.com. He is a writer for The American Prospect, writes for The Intercept, New Republic, Fiscal Times. His first book, Chain of Title, was released by the New Press on May of 2016. When we come back, Heather Digby-Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to figure out how you can become a member of this program.